Welcome to Healthy Her, the podcast designed to inspire women to lead lives filled with health and happiness. I'm Dr. Amy Brenner, your host discussing nutrition, hormones, aesthetics, sexual health, and more. Join us each week as we dive into feeling better, looking better, and living better.
The studies that we have show that hormone replacement, with the exception of testosterone, the general hormone replacement program does not increase the risk of breast cancer, may even decrease it. But we want to decrease it even further. We want to reduce the risk of breast cancer in our patient population.
Do you do metabolite testing for your patients, or do you just recommend people to take B-complex and indole-3-carbinol or DIM?
Yes, we give everybody DIM, diindolemethane. That's a broccoli extract that's available over the counter as a vitamin. So everybody, that's part of our breast cancer protection program, which this is a good spot to talk about that. So we've devised a breast cancer prevention program. And the two major components of that are, number one, the testosterone, which we've already discussed, is breast cancer preventive. And number two, iodine supplementation. The breast tissue needs iodine, and iodine deficiency is a risk factor for increased breast cancer. And there are quite a few studies that show that. For example, in Japan, where they have a very high iodine intake, mostly from seaweed in the diet, which is high in iodine, they have a very low breast cancer rate. Whereas when the Japanese migrate to the United States and they have less iodine in their diet, they have increased breast cancer. And then there are a number of laboratories, there are various laboratories around the world that study the use of iodine as a prevention and treatment for breast cancer. There's a laboratory in Mexico, Dr. Acevedes, that has done a lot of work in this area and shows that iodine is converted to this intermediary called iodolactones, which actually induce apoptosis in breast cancer cells. They've actually done studies in humans, in women, breast cancer patients, giving iodine tablets in addition to chemotherapy as an adjuvant treatment, in addition to conventional treatment, for example, with chemotherapy for breast cancer. And they show a dramatic improvement in the prognosis and outcome in cancer patients by adding iodine to the as an adjuvant treatment. So we have the testosterone, we have iodine, we have the DIM, diindolemethane, which is a broccoli extract. And we talked earlier about selenium. Selenium deficiency is increases risk for all cancers, including breast cancer. So we routinely include serum selenium on our laboratory testing. Quest and LabCorp, the major labs, will do a serum selenium. And we don't use the lab range for the for that. We use the 135 as our cutoff, which comes from the medical literature. So we're looking for, for example, the NPC trial, they were looking for selenium deficient patients to enter the trial, and their average selenium level was about 110, which they considered selenium deficient. So we want a level of at least 135 up to about 200. There is a thing called selenium toxicity, but I've actually never seen a patient diagnosed with selenium toxicity ever after 40 years of. If you have to look pretty hard in the medical literature to find any examples of selenium toxicity, it's mostly metal workers breathing in selenium dust, things like that. But there is a paper in the medical literature of there was a liquid mineral supplement that was mislabeled. It had 10,000 times the selenium that was listed on the label. It was, adulterated, and about 300 people got sick. Nobody died, but a few people were hospitalized. They checked serum selenium levels, and it was around 700. So you have to get really, it's extremely rare. It's almost impossible to get selenium toxicity. unless you have some kind of adulterated product that, of course, the FDA shut them down right away. So, you know, stick to selenium tablets. Don't use the liquids, and you'll be okay. So we give everyone selenium supplement. You know, most good multivitamins will contain selenium,
Right.
which usually covers that. And if somebody is severely selenium deficient, you know, 105, 110, then we'll give 200 micrograms, 200 to 400 micrograms of selenium, which is one or two tablets a day. So selenium is important for cancer prevention program. Vitamin D, you know, low vitamin D is a risk factor for all different types of cancers.
And you live in Florida. I bet you get a lot of pushback. Like I hear that from my patients of, well, I'm really tan and I go to Florida and I don't know about you, but I've never seen anybody unless they're supplementing with an adequate vitamin D level. What about you down in Florida?
Well, you know, that's true for the lifeguards. You know, the lifeguards on the beach, they're, you know, sort of bronze. You know, they're out in the sun, you know, and they have a beautiful tan. They have great vitamin D levels, but you know, we test everyone that comes in the office. That's included on our routinely in our lab panel, and what we see is, you know, people avoid the sun. You know, the dermatologist tells everyone, don't go in the sun; it's going to cause skin cancer. Stay away from the sun. So people, a lot of people do that, and they have, you know, selenium levels that are, we find low selenium levels, not in everybody, but occasionally we find levels in the 20s. And of course, we want it to be above 50, because the vitamin D, level is also, very important, for the immune system. You know, that's our major,
You mean you want the vitamin D level to be above 50?
Above
Yeah.
50. Where does the
Yeah.
50 come from? You know, for protection from upper respiratory viruses, for example. Where does that magic number of 50 come from? Their study was done on COVID patients in the hospital. If their vitamin D was above 50, the mortality rate was zero. Zero mortality from COVID in the hospital if your vitamin D is above zero. We should have been handing out vitamin D tablets to the entire population during COVID. The government should have been doing that, but they didn't, as you know. There were a lot of mistakes made. That was one of them. Above 50 is our target area. You know, the normal range for vitamin D goes from, you know, from roughly 30 or so up to 100 is the lab range. So there's plenty of room to go up in terms of vitamin D dosage. We do have some people who just take a lot of vitamin D, and they come in above the lab range on the initial testing, 110, 120. They're fine. We just tell them to take a break from it, and then we check it again. There is a thing. There is vitamin D toxicity. It's associated. It does cause hypercalcemia. So as long as their serum calcium is normal, you know, we just let the vitamin D levels drift back down. Sometimes we'll see high calcium on people taking vitamin D, which is in a normal range, and we tell them to take a break from the vitamin D. So you know, that's our breast cancer prevention program. It's the testosterone, iodine supplementation, selenium, vitamin D, the DIM, diindolemethane. And then, of course, you have some patients, you know, there's a whole population of people with MTHFR mutations. That's the involved in methylation. It's a mutation in the methylation pathway. And they need methylfolate, which most good quality multivitamins will have that version of methylfolate, you know, the methylfolate version, whereas the lower quality multivitamins will have just plain folate, which of course is not going to be useful to them because they lack the enzyme to convert it to methylfolate. So they need the methylfolate so they can have good methylation. Well,
You know, I don't know if you have any slides there. We talked about estrogen lowering the risk of breast cancer, testosterone lowering the risk of breast cancer. We talked about, on the other hand, synthetic progestins raising the risk of breast cancer. I don't know if you have anything easily to pull up of any data showing that bioidentical natural progesterone also lowers your risk of breast cancer. I don't know if you have any of those slides at your fingertips.
Well, that you know the that th there's a great article which summarizes most of the all the studies on progesterone as breast cancer protective, and that's by Lieberman. So let me try to pull up Lieberman. And it's titled In Defense of Progesterone, review of the literature from 2017. And so, if you read through this, he basically goes through all of the studies which show that progesterone is breast cancer protective and does not cause breast cancer. And I'll just scroll down to the to the conclusions down here. And again, this is what I've been harping on over and over again. Confusion in the medical literature: synthetic progestins have mistakenly described as natural progesterone, and that this is rampant throughout the medical literature. So you have these flawed studies that attribute adverse risk factors to progesterone when in fact they use synthetic progestins.
Yeah, it amazes me. I'll read articles and they'll say progesterone, progesterone, progesterone does all these horrible things. And then when you dive into it, it was actually a synthetic progestin. So even these
Exactly.
authors and physicians don't know the difference between bioidentical natural progesterone and a synthetic progestin.
It's exact. Well, part of that, I think, is maybe I'm a conspiracy theorist, but I think part of that is due to the pharmaceutical industry marketing. I think there was an intentional blurring of the difference between between progesterone and progestins. And the pharmaceutical industry, they pay the speakers at the meetings, the hormone meetings, and I think part of this is intentional, but it certainly worked. Here it is right here. This is the final conclusion. The authors wish to emphasize that natural progesterone is preventive of breast and endometrial cancer, and physicians should have no hesitation pr providing it, prescribing it. The progestins were introduced because of increased endometrial hyperplasia. Yes, estrogen, unopposed estrogen will cause endometrial hyperplasia, which leads to endometrial cancer.
Right.
So when we say that estrogen does not cause breast cancer, we have to say that yes, it does cause endometrial cancer.
Yeah. Now, what are your thoughts on, again, I think most OBGYNs, if the patient has a hysterectomy, they only put the patient on estrogen. And I think there are progesterone receptors all over our body, more than just the uterus. And I talk to patients about the benefits of progesterone, even when they've had a hysterectomy. What is your talk track when you're seeing patients who've had a hysterectomy about progesterone?
We will give everyone progesterone even if they've had a hysterectomy, and it's there are progesterone receptors everywhere, especially in the brain. And progesterone, estrogen tends to be brain stimulatory. There are basically two major pathways in the brain: inhibitory and stimulatory. The inhibitory are for example, the benzodiazepine drugs, that's the GABA system, will inhibit, they cause sedation. And then you have the stimulatory system, which is the glutamate system. So estrogen is known to be stimulatory to the brain. And so, women, a lot of women will have anxiety from too much brain stimulation. And various other mood disorders, and they need progesterone, which counteracts the this the inhibit the it's progesterone is inhibitory, whereas estrogen is stimulatory. So they balance each other in the brain very nicely, and I think that's a major benefit. And then this study by Lieberman shows that progesterone is breast cancer protective, so that's another good reason to get progesterone. And then there's some studies that show that progesterone will help with bone density. So there are various other health benefits of progesterone, which just I think justify using progesterone in
Yeah,
addition,
put an
even in
agreement.
hysterectomy patients. So Lieberman goes into this, is a big section on progesterone as a neuroprotective. It protects the brain.
Yeah.
on
What
behalf.
about your, can you explain to people why transdermal estrogen or is better than taking estrogen pills or orally?
Yes. A lot of that work is done by Scarabin, who's a doctor in Paris. He spent about 20, 30 years of his career studying the thrombogenic properties of oral estrogen. Now remember, in the naturally in the female human female, estrogen is not consumed as an oral. As an oral hormone, it's produced by the ovary, which is then secreted directly into the bloodstream. So when we take estrogen orally, then there's first pass through the liver, which means the estrogen is converted into metabolites by the liver, which are thrombogenic and increase blood clotting, which is perhaps better known. With estrogen in oral contraceptive pills. When, for example, when I worked at the hospital doing angiography, my job as a radiologist, diagnostic radiologist, was I did the angiograms. We, from time to time, we would have a young female in her 20s or 30s with a lifeless arm from a stroke caused by taking birth control pills from the, and that's from the thrombogenic activity of oral estrogen. So that type of thing will show up in, in other studies. For example, the Women's Health Initiative study where they gave oral estrogen, that thrombogenic effect was so bad they had to halt the studies early, because women were developing deep venous thrombosis and embolic phenomenon, pulmonary emboli, and strokes from the blood clots caused by the oral estrogen. So there are a number of studies comparing oral estrogen with transdermal estrogen, and you can look at all of these different thrombogenic components, fibrinogen levels, D-dimer levels, things like that, and what happened to CRP levels. And the oral estrogen will increase CRP and increase all these thrombogenic markers, whereas the transdermal estrogen will not increase any of those markers.
Right. So are
So
you feel comfortable giving transdermal estrogen to people who have had DVT or pulmonary embolus?
I think the one contraindication is going to be women who have a mutation. They have a genetic disease called thrombophilia. Factor V Leiden is probably one of the more common. There are a few others. And so those women will have a greater tendency to form blood clots from it. For example, from a long airplane flight, where if they don't get up and walk around every half hour, every hour, they can develop blood clots in the deep venous system of the legs. The other group of people that are very thrombogenic and form blood clots are the people on chemotherapy. Chemotherapy, they will tend to be thrombogenic. I think those types of women who have a history of deep venous thrombosis, they have to be dealt with on an individual basis. It very rarely we actually see somebody like that. And I think we do have one patient who had a history of deep venous thrombosis, which recanalized and she recovered with a history of she took a long plane ride, then she the next day after she arrived, she went shopping and noticed that her leg was swollen, and she kind of hobbled around for a few days and it got better. That's an obvious history. That's an obvious case of it. She had, she had a blood clot in her deep venous system that recanalized and she recovered. But the question is, would you give a hormone replacement to a patient with that kind of history? I think we do have one that's doing well with hormone replacement.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is no matter what you do, patients like that are at increased risk of getting another blood clot. But I just think that scientifically, that transdermal estrogen, there's no scientific explanation of it stimulating clotting factors. So, but where, people get
I
on.
definitely would not. I definitely would not give them oral estrogen pills
Oh,
or
for sure.
pills. But
Yeah.
the transdermal estrogen should be I believe is okay. And if we look at those cases on an individual basis, and maybe do some genetic testing for thrombophilia disorders, and then we can give them the transdermal program, transdermal hormone program. Baby aspirin, a lot of them are already taking baby aspirin just to reduce platelet adhesiveness. Vitamin E is also very good for vitamin E is a blood thinner. It has a lot of health benefits. Those are the types of thoughts that we have in those cases.
So there's just so much you and I could probably talk about all of the aspects of hormones, but I won't take up all your time. How I found you is I recommend your book, Bioidentical Hormones 101. I should have brought it in with me. I don't know if you have a copy right next to you to show everybody. So great book. So I think this
Thank
is
you.
how I first found out about you. And then I started following your newsletter, which is, almost like a little mini fellowship for physicians.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, this came out in 2011, so it's almost, 13, 14 years old. A lot of the materials, maybe 15 years old. So there's a lot of new material since the book came out. So I'm currently working on a second edition, and I'm in the process of just compiling all of this information for the second edition. So hopefully that'll come out in the next 6 months or so. And
That's
we're
great.
just feverishly working our little fingers to the bone on that.
So where can people find you?
We have a free newsletter, comes out on the first of the month every month. Everything is original, written by me. All you have to do is go to my website, which is first name, last name, Jeffrey-DA, spelled DACHMD.com. Jeffrey, Jeffrey, DACHMD.com. And then I'm also on Facebook. I'm also on Twitter, or it's now called X. Elon Musk changed the name. And then, if you put my first name, last name into any search engine, the website should pop up, and then you can find it that way. But remember to spell my last name with a C, DACH,
Awesome.
to make it easier. And then, we're in Florida. We're in Davie, Florida. My office is in Davie on Griffin, if you go to Amazon, I have a few other books available on Amazon. I have a cancer book that's very popular called Cracking Cancer Toolkit, and which I wrote because a number of people in my family came down with aggressive cancer, and so I had to get up to speed on various repurposed drugs for cancer. And so luckily, all of my family members who had aggressive cancer are doing well and in remission. So we've had some good luck with using the various treatments in the book. I also have a book on the heart disease, which is called Heart Book, which came out in, I think, 2017 or 2018. So there's also new material since then that I have to do a second edition on that. And then my latest book, which just came out over the summer of 2023, is Natural Thyroid Toolkit.
Oh, I didn't know about that one. So.
There's a it's the paper the ebook is only $1 on Amazon, so you can get the whole electronic version for a buck. This is the histology of the thyroid with a little colloid in the middle, little colloid protein, which is the thyroid globulin. And this is probably the most definitive book, a recent definitive book on natural thyroid.
Thanks for joining us and dispelling this myth that bioidentical hormones cause cancer. Thanks for listening to Healthy Her. If you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a quick 5-star review on your podcast platform. Your feedback means the world to us and helps others discover our show. Do you have questions or want to discuss a particular topic? You can reach us by emailing ask@dramiebrenner.com or calling 513-204-8403 and leaving a voicemail. We might feature your question or comment in an upcoming episode, so don't miss out on the chance to be a part of the conversation. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes. We appreciate your support and can't wait to have you back with us next time. Take care and remember, your Healthy Her journey begins with you. This podcast is for general information only and does not constitute medical advice, the practice of medicine, nursing, or other healthcare services. No patient-physician relationship is formed. The information in the podcast and any references, material, or links are at the sole discretion of the listener and not meant to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should not delay or disregard obtaining medical advice for any medical diagnosis or issues that they may have and should seek medical care or advice from their healthcare provider for any such conditions.